Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of Global Financial Investment Services, LLP, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Any investments based on Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Richard Martin of the PRN, not exactly the website, but an alternative. In the absence of PRN that has, as you know, been having severe problems, the date on which this show is meant for dissemination is Friday, March the 6th, 2015, and you are hopefully being able to access it through means which, as of the moment of recording, which was 2 days earlier on Wednesday, we had not yet established. I will have more information for you, and you will hopefully be able to get your shows twice a week from here on out, and I will reveal to you the means by which we have managed to do this in a forthcoming show. But in the meantime, the gentleman that has most kindly intervened and helped us out, to him I offer absolutely the most grateful thanks for his kindness in doing this. So right now I do not have a state of play at PRN. I do not know what the situation is there and when they will be back to normal. But I ask you please, ladies and gentlemen, to take down this information that you have used. Please take it down and keep it close to you, and also keep my phone number close to you. My phone number, as you know, being 941-441-1682. Keep that close to you. Keep also my email close to you, because I have no idea what might happen in the future, and I want you to be able to contact me. So please use either my phone number again, which is area code 941-441-1682, or use my email address, which is rm@gfawd.com. Again, that's RM for Richard Martin, at GFAWD for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design, GFAWD.com. Let me give you that one more final time, RM@GFAWD.com. And at that point, I will be able to give you updated information, and hopefully we will be able to continue from here on out without any further glitches. Now, let's get on with the show. I have decided to talk to you today in much more detail about the prelude to what I am afraid is inevitable and unstoppable war. And by war, I don't mean a skirmish with Grenada or El Salvador or Iraq. I'm talking about a major clash between the big powers, initiated or instigated, of course, by the United States of America, directly or indirectly, along with one of the other powers, or both, namely China and or Russia. We need to follow this through. We need to face it. And as always, ladies and gentlemen, you need to decide how you are going to deal with this on a personal basis. And I say personal because, as you all know, my show is about you. It's not about Congress. It's not about President Obama. It's about you, my listeners, and what to do on an individual basis if and when you find that you need help in the crisis which is about to unfold, sadly, in a very grim and destructive manner. You need to know what you can do and what you should do to protect yourselves and your families. Well, war is, as you know, the theme of my year. It was war with China last year, and it has now morphed into a second year of war. And basically, described as simply war. We will be dealing with this as the months go by this year, 2015, and we hopefully will manage to make it through the year without the breakout of some skirmish which turns into a major conflagration courtesy of madmen like John McCain. But, you know, the drumbeats of war are pounding. Sanctions are implemented against any country that dares question American imperialism, as in Russia or Iran. Overthrow and ignominious imprisonment or death awaits any foreign leader questioning the petrodollar or standing in the way of America spreading democracy. Think Iraq, Libya, Syria, Ukraine, or Egypt. The mega media complex of six corporations peddle the government-issued pabulum about ISIS being an existential threat to our freedom, Russia being led by the new Hitler and poised to take over Europe, Syria gassing innocent women and children, and Iran only 6 months away from a nuclear bomb. They've been 6 months away for the last 14 years. Hollywood does its part with patriotic drivel like American Sniper, designed to compel low IQ, unemployed American youths to swell with pride and march down to enlistment centers located in America's plentiful urban ghettos. You know, the most disconcerting aspect of these situations is that they've always climaxed with total, destructive, all-out war. Not wars to enrich arms dealers like Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria, but incomprehensibly violent, brutal wars of annihilation. There are clear winners and losers at the conclusion of end-of-climax wars. Leaders mobilize all forces, refuse to compromise, define their enemies in moral terms, demand sacrifice on the battlefield and home front, build the most destructive weapons imaginable, and employ those weapons to obtain victory at any cost. It may seem inconceivable that war on such a scale will happen within the next 10 years. But, you know, it was equally inconceivable in 1936 that 65 million people were about to die in the following 10 years during World War II. We valued all the wrong things and made all the wrong choices leading up to this crisis and during the early stages of the crisis. The accumulation of unmet obligations, unpaid bills, unkept promises and unresolved issues will provide the fuel for an upheaval that will shake our society to its core and transform America's direction for many decades to come. The outcome of the conflict will be unmitigated tragedy. Political choices will make no difference whatsoever. There will be war on many fronts, and many wars have already begun. The culmination will be World War III, and the outcome will be highly uncertain, but utterly disastrous. Right now, the world is awash in sovereign debt, as governments have overpromised welfare benefits. Every country is attempting to debase their currency in order to make their debt load bearable. The problem with this approach is that if every country implements the same strategy, it becomes a race to the bottom. Japan is leading the race and is, as of today, the most likely candidate to cause a catastrophic collapse in the global financial system. The European Union and their negative interest rate strategy is crushing the euro, but failing to address the solvency issue at the heart of the bank-centric European mad experiment. The depression engulfing Japan, the recession overwhelming Europe, and the rapidly deflating Chinese malinvestment bubbles had dramatically reduced demand for oil, copper, and iron ore. The collapse in demand for oil has caused the currencies of Russia, Venezuela, Mexico, and Brazil to plunge. Argentina, Turkey, and the Ukraine risk hyperinflation as their economies are basket cases. The result of rapidly declining currencies is more pain and suffering for the middle and lower classes. As prices rise for food, energy, and essentials, the peasants get restless. This leads to anger, extremist parties gaining traction, and ultimately revolution. Since the end of World War II, the US dollar has been the currency in which all world trade has been conducted. The global oil trade has been settled in dollars. American economic warfare aggression against Russia, China, Iran, and other developing countries has pushed them into closer economic cooperation. The dollar's days of domination are numbered. The current strength of the dollar is only a reflection of the US being the best-looking horse in the glue factory. The US economy is the least bad, but it will certainly not be decoupling from the global downturn. The movement of physical gold from west to east is a reflection of a shift in power. U.S. mega corporations get half their profits overseas, and they face the double whammy of slowing demand and a stronger dollar. The combination will crush their profits and contribute to the coming stock market crash. When Greece exits the European Union, the currency wars could easily, if indirectly, lead to a real war in Europe. Remember what Warren Buffett said as he was trying to show solidarity with the underclass, quote unquote. There's a class warfare, all right, but it's my class, the rich class, that's making war, and we're winning. The meme driving Occupy Wall Street protests was the 1% versus the 99%. The comparison is misleading. The 1% includes many small business owners, productive professionals, successful physicians, and hard-working entrepreneurs. The true class war is between the 0.1% and the 99.9%. There's a small clique of bankers, billionaires, corporate CEOs, media moguls, politicians, and their acolytes, who represent the invisible government and control the mechanisms of financial markets through their capture of the system. There's absolutely no question but that they're winning. It's hard not to win when the game is rigged in your favor by your fellow 0.1% cronies. The markets are no longer free. They are rigged to benefit the 0.1% at everyone else's expense. The wealth of the richest has skyrocketed, while the wealth of the rest has fallen since 2009. Real median household income languishing at 1989 levels proves the vast majority of the people have been the losers. The next financial collapse initiated by the policies designed to benefit the 0.1% is likely to push class warfare into the streets. Gated communities and doormen will not save the 0.1% from the wrath of their victims. A particularly dicey war is the one between the older and the younger generations. In past cycle terms, the profit generation, evidenced this time by the boomers, has provided leadership for the hero generation, this time represented by the millennials. The tension between older and younger generations is palpable. Older generations have accumulated wealth during the good times. The boomers who didn't save for their retirement refuse to yield the field and allow millennials into the workforce. Millions of delusional boomers used the easy debt provided by the bankers to live for today and never save for tomorrow. Well, ladies and gentlemen, tomorrow is here. The older generations are still going to receive all the social benefits they were promised, while younger generations will get stiffed. They know they're going to get screwed, and they're likely to take it, but unlikely to take it lying down. It's the older generations who control the levers of society. The aging ruling class has doled out the hundreds of billions in student loan debt and convinced millennials college was a sure path to success and good jobs. Working as a French fry jockey at McDonald's doesn't make the grade as a good job. Young people without jobs and without hope are what you might call a particularly combustible concoction. If there is revolution in the streets, it won't be led by obese boomers on their motorized scooters. The barricades will be manned by the young. Confrontation with the police state may be initiated by Gen Xers and boomers, but the fighting and dying will be done by the millennials. The war on terrorism, like the wars on drugs and poverty, is unwinnable. Such wars aren't meant to be won. They're meant to enrich the vested interests, expand their control over our lives, erode our liberties and freedoms, and provoke fear and dependence among the masses. The terrorist plots concocted by the government use clueless dupes and are then foiled by the DHS agencies that created them. They are nothing but a ruse to rile up the easily manipulated hoi polloi. The neocons want to leave the Middle East a smoking crater in their thirst for blood. The war on terrorism is a cover for hijacking the oil under the ground in the Middle East. ISIS is now Satan. Hitler and Attila the Hun rolled into one, even though they didn't exist a year ago. They are the existential threat of the day, the excuse for U.S. troops and armaments to flow back into Iraq. The military-industrial complex profits will surge. Despite the fact these terrorists are no threat to your American way of life, the level of fear-mongering amongst the chattering classes in Versailles on the Potomac and on the entertainment news networks is at hyperbolic volumes. Chris Hedges explains the current propaganda storyline as espoused by the deep state, and I quote, "This sentimentality, as Baldwin wrote, masks a terrifying numbness. The war culture fosters an unchecked narcissism. Facts and historical truths, when they do not fit into the mythic vision of the nation and the tribe, are discarded. Dissent becomes treason. All opponents are godless and subhuman. It holds up the dangerous belief that we can recover our equilibrium and our lost glory by embracing an American fascism." End of quote. Well, somebody needs to inform the neocons they don't hate America for its freedoms. They hate the U.S. for occupying their lands, raining terror on their people from unmanned killer drones, invading their countries, interfering in their political processes, and stealing their oil. The Middle East will remain a quagmire of hatred, centuries-old animosities, religious extremism, despotic leaders, and oil. Terrorism does not pose an existential threat to the United States. It's laughable to conclude that a country of 320 million, protected by vast oceans, with a $1 trillion military and 300 million guns distributed among its population, is actually threatened by a few thousand illiterate religious zealots in the Middle East? Terrorism is a tactic used by militant groups unable to wage an insurgency or fight a conventional war. The purpose is to lure a larger enemy into an outsized response, resulting in bleeding and bankrupting the larger foe. Osama bin Laden succeeded beyond his wildest expectations. The U.S. has wasted $6 trillion thus far, along with the lives of 7,000 Americans and 50,000 wounded. The terrorists have already won. They have set your country on the path to bankruptcy while convincing your leaders to strip the citizens of their liberties, freedoms, and rights. And there are now more militants and terrorists than there were in 2001, in countries that didn't have terrorists in 2001. Ladies and gentlemen, the Middle East is a power keg which could perfectly easily be the catalyst for the start of World War III. A cyber war has been waged against the American people and foreign allies by the NSA for the last decade. The technology-addicted masses are completely oblivious to their loss of privacy and freedom. They don't know or don't care that their rights under the Fourth Amendment are being abridged. You are being tracked and monitored through your electronic devices. Your TV is recording your conversations. The U.S. has been waging cyber war against enemies and allies alike. The U.S. unleashed the Stuxnet computer virus into the Iranian nuclear program computers to set back their efforts by years. That was an act of war. It is now comical to see the governmental outrage when foreign nations and hacker organizations break into government computers and wreak havoc. In cyber war, the playing field is fairly even. Even North Korea can create problems for a superpower. Obama and his acolytes should duly note that Wall Street hired hundreds of Russian computer programmers because they seem to have a penchant for writing code. I'm sure Putin realizes that too. Hackers have already caused billions in damage to retailers like Target, Home Depot, Staples, Sears, and Neiman Marcus. Over 1,000 merchants have had their computer networks breached. Hackers could potentially bring the financial system to its knees with a few keystrokes. Foreign governments have their smartest tech geeks probing U.S. computer networks for weaknesses, and will act on these weaknesses when they feel it's beneficial to their interests. Technology will not save the world, but it might play a part in ending it. All the military firepower at America's disposal may be nothing more than its own brand of Maginot Line during the next worldwide conflict. If satellites and computer systems can be disabled through computer code, leaders will be blind, deaf, and dumb to threats. This would ratchet up the odds of someone panicking and pushing the wrong button at the wrong time. The future of the world most assuredly hangs in the balance. It appears this coming primary driving force will be the internal conflict between government and the people. To linear thinkers, self-proclaimed progressives, corrupt politicians, obedient government workers, and those dependent upon the government for their sustenance, the thought of civil war in the United States is inconceivable. Civil uprisings generally occur after currency collapse, when mass hunger and poverty overtake the land. If the electronic-based economic system caused store shelves to go empty, fuel to become scarce, and the electronic transfer of welfare benefits to cease, there would be mass chaos in the streets. With the horrendous shortcomings of America's just-in-time supply chain, the nation would be brought to its knees within 1 week following, let's say, a grid failure or breakdown of electronic ordering, payment, and communication. Millions would perish within a few weeks. The government would attempt to mobilize the military and National Guard to maintain order. With their families also starving and no means of getting paid, ask yourselves whether they will be obeying the orders of a government that caused the collapse. Remember New York a few weeks ago when the police said they'd make only the most urgent arrests? One has to wonder why they ever make the others, but that's another subject for another day. The other possibility is secession. It's been tried before, and the conflict was bloody and earth-shattering. There really are two Americas. The East and West Coasts are dominated by the liberal elite, who look down upon the rest of the country. The 0.1% mostly resides in their gated enclaves, penthouse suites, and luxury beachfront mansions. They have nothing but contempt and disdain for the average American living in Middle America or the South. The feeling is mutual amongst the working class towards the liberal elites. Most of the 300 million guns are concentrated in the Midwest and South. As trust in government and institutions wanes, the issue of states' rights is likely to gain traction amongst a large swath of the critical thinking citizenry. The animosity between factions in the United States is at historic levels. Again, civil war, secession, and the nation breaking into sectional regions of common interests are unlikely to occur until the existing social order collapses under the weight of unpayable obligations. That time is coming. Every previous climax coincided with total war on a grand scale. Each such war has seen a leap in the technological means of killing human beings. We put a lot of effort and resources into finding better ways to annihilate humanity. The Civil War saw 5% of the male population killed. World War II saw 65 million people killed. How many will die during this coming total war of survival? These kinds of war are decisive, final, and fought with all necessary means until final victory or defeat, not like Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, or Afghanistan. World War I was savage and brutal, but it was not decisive. It left issues unresolved, and its Treaty of Versailles created the basis for World War II. The technological means to put an end to mankind is at the disposal of leaders in a number of nation-states. It would only take one psychopathic despot or elected president of immense ego and self-importance to initiate the doomsday clock. It appears these qualities are now essential to governing a modern-day nation. Someone will do something stupid, and then all hell will break loose. Anyone who doesn't comprehend the implications of alliances being formed and broken by countries around the globe is either choosing the ostrich strategy or is ignorant of history and the events leading to wars. A thorough reading of The Guns of August may be helpful. The world is like a room full of gunpowder, and the sociopaths running the show keep lighting matches. Someone is going to miscalculate, and the place is going to blow sky high. The insolvent European Union is splintering. The northern countries despise the southern countries. Greece, Spain, and Italy are all economic basket cases, and their exits will mark the end of this grand experiment in debt delusion. Once the bad debts crash down upon the European banks and governments, the anger, bitterness, accusations, and violence will reach epic proportions. This could trigger war, as extremist political parties gain traction. The economic suffering in the 1920s led to the rise of Mussolini and Hitler. Hunger leads the peasants to rally behind any strong leader. The Ukrainian civil war, crafted by the US and its weak-kneed NATO allies, has been the facilitator of a shift in world alliances. The U.S. has made a blundering attempt to teach Putin a lesson for interfering in their Syrian pipeline uprising against Assad and encouraging the Crimea to rejoin Russia. By attempting to position NATO armaments on Russia's border, they have triggered centuries-old fears of being invaded by European powers. Russia will stop the U.S. plan at all costs, and the Russian-supported rebels have soundly defeated the Kiev Nazi forces in eastern Ukraine. The U.S.-backed forces have slaughtered women and children randomly as they blunder about in eastern Ukraine. The latest ceasefire will not hold. Germany and France are coming to their senses and starting to look out for their best interests rather than the interests of the American bullies. A shattering of the NATO alliance would be an earth-moving event and would set the stage for further conflict in Europe. Enemies are interchangeable when you are an imperial power. The world has begun to devolve into two distinct factions. The imperialist actions of American influence in the Middle East and Ukraine have pushed Russia, China, India, Brazil, and Iran closer together regarding trade deals, transacting commerce without using the United States dollar, oil and gas pipelines, and military cooperation. If there's going to be total war in the next dozen or so years, it most surely would be the United States versus an alliance of Russia and China. Japan is experiencing Chinese saber-rattling over disputed islands. Russia continuously probes NATO defenses with aggressive actions. It is clear the U.S. has decided Vladimir Putin and Russia is world enemy number one, and are using all their economic and propaganda tools to declaw the bear. Failure to make Putin bow to American pressure will raise his stature at home and abroad. China's domestic economic and social issues continue to worsen. They are in the midst of experiencing an epic bust after a debt-fueled explosion of government-manufactured growth. Their fraudulent economic boom is coming to a messy end. Totalitarian regimes are known for using foreign threats to distract the populace from domestic suffering. As a matter of fact, all regimes use this tactic. When the global economy rips apart at the seams due to the debt saturation, world leaders will attempt to blame other countries for their dire circumstances. Foreign enemies are good for business. Ask your Nobel Peace Prize-winning president. War is inevitable. Strauss and Howe's fourth turning poses four potential culminations to the current crisis, only one of which offers hope. There may be other possibilities, but probably not. The outcome which will not happen is just a continuation of the status quo with the same corrupt leadership using the same debt-based solutions as they enrich themselves and their cronies. The existing social order will be replaced by something new, but not necessarily better, if there is anything left after a war that could end in Armageddon. 1. This fourth turning could mark the end of man. It could be an omnicidal Armageddon, destroying everything, leaving nothing. If mankind ever extinguishes itself, this will probably happen when its dominant civilization triggers an event that ends horribly. For this fourth turning to put an end to life as we know it would require a blend of social disaster, human malevolence, technological perfection, and bad luck. 2. The fourth turning could mark the end of modernity. The Western secular rhythm, which began in the mid-15th century with the Renaissance, could come to an abrupt end. The seventh modern seculum would be the last. This too could come from total war, terrible but not final. There could be a complete collapse of science, culture, politics, and society. Such a dire result would probably happen only when a dominant nation, like today's America, lets a fourth turning pyrosis engulf the planet. But this outcome is well within the reach of foreseeable technology and malevolence. 3. The fourth turning could spare modernity, but mark the end of America. It could close the book on the political constitution, popular culture, and moral standing that the world America has come to signify. The nation has endured for three secular. Rome lasted 12, the Soviet Union only one. Fourth turnings are critical thresholds for national survival. Each of the last three American crises produced moments of extreme danger. In the Revolution, the very birth of the Republic hung by a thread in more than one battle. In the Civil War, the Union barely survived a four-year slaughter that in its own time was regarded as the most lethal war in history. In World War II, the nation destroyed an enemy of democracy that for a time was winning. Had the enemy won, America might have itself been destroyed. In all likelihood, The next crisis will present the nation with a threat and a consequence on a similar scale. 4. Or the fourth turning could simply mark the end of the millennial seculum. Mankind, modernity, and America would all persevere. Afterwards, there would be a new mood, a new high, and a new seculum. America would be reborn. But reborn, it would not be the same. I would love to just be an impartial observer during this coming horror. Like a sports announcer in a booth far above the field, broadcasting the events as they unfold. But it is not to be. I'm living in the midst of this crisis with all the other participants. I'm not happy about the prospect of financial collapse, societal collapse, and war. I understand the younger generations must do the heavy lifting during this crisis, but I do not relish the prospect of putting them in harm's way. It's not fair that they are left with the burdens created by decades of bad choices and cowardly acts of their elders. But no one said life is fair. This generation was born at a particular time in history when much will be required. They have a rendezvous with destiny. None of us has a choice. We can't sit this one out. The bad times ahead will require courage, fortitude, sacrifice, and intelligence. Your individual decisions and choices will matter. Ladies and gentlemen, you really do need to prepare now. I, for one, will be ramping this up from here on out. Time is running out. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, let me give you my information, as I am wont to do when we are live at PRN. I do not have a call-in number for you right now. We are working on that, and hopefully something will manifest itself in the weeks to come. But in the meantime, let me give you yet again my email address, which you will need if we are not able to go live for an extended period at PRN. And that email address is rm@gfawd.com. It's the same email address that we've had throughout, but please be prepared to use it if needed. Again, that's RM for Richard Martin, at GFAWD for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design.com. Let me give you that one more time. RM@GFAWD.com. And my direct line, if you wish to call me in private about your individual issues, that remains the same, that has not changed. And it is 941-441-1682. That's a number in the United States. It is a number in Sarasota, Florida, which carries right the way through to Southeast Asia. So please don't hesitate to call it. Again, the number is 941-441-1682. Well, subprime lending is at its highest level since the financial crisis hit. The three leading subprime categories are auto loans, credit cards, and student debt. $189 billion in subprime loans was made in 2014. So, ladies and gentlemen, subprime, the very aspect of the crisis which was sworn never to happen again, is back with a vengeance. The euphoria is bleeding into every corner of America's debt-driven economy. Access to credit is being given to consumers, but the loans are tied to items that cannot possibly become financially healthy. Subprime loans have already reached levels that were last seen only during the financial crisis. As fewer good borrowers are available, lenders are digging into every nook and cranny of the economy to find additional borrowers. Money is brought into existence through debt. People have a hard time absorbing this essential fact. For example, say you are a student looking at going to college but have $0 to pay for it. A lender will pay for your school and create this so-called money out of thin air. All of a sudden, you graduate and now owe $50,000, for example. You will need to pay this back with real earned income for many years. This is money that was brought into the system by financial institutions, and we are now seeing it permeate into auto loans and credit cards with subprime borrowers. In 2014, as I said, $189 billion in subprime loans were made. Welcome back to the easy debt party. Subprime lending is rising in a big way. We started noticing this many years ago with college loans being given to students to attend for-profit institutions. Many of the for-profits target low-income neighborhoods and realize that many will qualify for government loans and grants. Quality of education doesn't really matter so long as they can get these students in. The money is created out of the financial system's magic, and the big winners are the institutions, not the students. Another category that we have seen more recently funnel money at subprime borrowers is with auto loans. The Wall Street Journal compiled some fascinating figures on subprime lending. There is nearly as much subprime auto debt as there was in 2006, when the market was going crazy on lending junk loans. $129 billion in subprime auto debt was made in 2014. $21 billion in subprime credit debt card debt was extended in 2014. Another $26 billion in subprime personal loans were made in 2014. And of course, we now have over $1.2 trillion in student debt, and a good portion of this is subprime since it's being made to many students going to low-quality schools, and many have no way of paying it off or even getting rid of it via bankruptcy, unlike card debt or credit card debt. A good portion of today's consumer spending is coming from marginal borrowers. People are living on the marginal edge, and we already know half of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. Giving people access to subprime debt is not going to make their financial future more secure. All it's doing is allowing them to consume future income, which in many cases is in the form of low wages, and causing any ability for financial security to disappear. This is the reality of subprime debt. Almost 4 of every 10 loans for autos, credit cards, and personal borrowing in the U.S. went to subprime customers during the first 11 months of 2014, according to data compiled for the Wall Street Journal by credit reporting firm Equifax. That amounted to more than 50 million consumer loans and cards, totaling more than $189 billion, the highest levels since 2007, when subprime loans represented 41% of consumer lending apart from home mortgages. Equifax defines subprime borrowers as those with a credit score below 640 on a scale that tops out at 850. Lower credit scores reflect late payments or too much debt relative to income. So by giving those with lower scores more debt, it's logical to expect more defaults once slight hiccups hit. Subprime is back again, and of course, the current narrative is that it's different this time. All right, let me now give you an email that I received from Jeffrey Teague as follows. Hello, Richard. I have enjoyed your shows, and I have learned much, and of course, this should continue for a long time to come, we hope. I have two questions to ask you. One pertains to our current economic indicators and who to believe. The second deals with those who are on Social Security in the U.S. and could not conceivably afford to leave the country. First question must be prefaced with this recently viewed video of Queen Elizabeth at the London School of Economics, where she asked, "How come nobody saw it? The 2008 crash and banking fiasco? Coming." Martin Wolf of Financial Times of London, touted as the main man economist, said, "You will never see these things coming because the system is ultimately too complicated for any one person to understand." My question would be, would you please characterize and explode your thoughts concerning this answer? Well, Jeffrey, explode seems like a rather pejorative verb to describe my rather innocent and modest explanation of my thoughts, and I do actually think you probably meant explain, but somehow your word checker took it to explode. So I won't explode, but I will attempt to explain. Yes, indeed, the system is actually much too hard for the average person to understand. Of course it is. And that's by design. It could be very easy to understand if the powers that be wanted you to understand it. But their success depends upon you not understanding it. And so, therefore, you will have to deal with people like me who try to sort it all out for you and ignore the mainstream press, which simply serves to exacerbate the situation and tell you how good everything is because that's what their bosses want to hear. And of course, as we move towards the imminent crisis, you will not read anywhere in the mainstream press about how devastating this is likely to be and what's likely to happen, which doesn't, of course, take away the reality that it is likely to happen, and I just spent the best part of 40 minutes telling you all about it. But it's not because, as Martin Wolf says, the system is too complicated. It's because they don't want you to know. All right, Jeffrey, let's go on to your second question, which is prefaced with, "While I am in the Philippines on Social Security and a small pension from New York City, and gratefully not in the U.S., I suffer for my fellow Americans and what is about to come from the government. The angst, of course, is that those who still have minds can see a damn good reason for leaving the U.S. simply cannot. My friends in particular, filmmakers, jazz musicians, etc. I wonder if you had some insights on foreign countries that would be apropos to those situations. Before I came to the Philippines, I made sure that I could still receive Social Security here, as there are limitations that Social Security puts on travelers. Please consider one more thing. At one point during a financial meltdown in the U.S., do you think that Social Security payments would be stopped? Myself, I consider this is the most dangerous move the government could make towards the people. What do you think? Best you, Richard, and keep on keeping on. Jeff Teague." Well, Jeff, first of all, I will stick my neck out here and say that I do not think that Social Security payments will cease. I think that the printing of the money, when push comes to shove, instead of going to banks and the cronies and the 0.1 percenters, will indeed go to the Social Security recipients, if only because withholding them will surely lead to a social unrest, an uprising, and a revolution. So I don't think that will happen. They will find ways of paying the Social Security recipients, even if the contributions might increase dramatically in the process. I don't think that they will be made unavailable to those who leave the country, because after all, in the end, the United States depends upon foreigners bringing money into the U.S. And if the foreigners give the impression that the money might never back out again, then they are unlikely to bring it in, and that will bring any remaining trade to a halt, PDQ. So there are problems to consider. There are elements of the crisis you need to pay attention to. But, Jeff, I think this gives me the opportunity to state unequivocally that you do not need to concern yourself with things which, in my opinion, just simply don't require your attention, because they're simply not going to happen. So don't worry. Your Social Security will continue to come, in my opinion, of course, and you should consider that you will be able to receive them indefinitely through the process of bank transfers between your bank and your bank in the Philippines, given bona fide references of your permanent residency in the Philippines. All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for today's show. I hope you will be able to listen. I hope you have enjoyed the show. I will be recording my shows from here on out, so please be prepared to receive on Monday, hopefully, another show by the same means. And I wish you all a wonderful weekend. This is Richard Martin, The Wake Up Call, saying bye-bye till then, and take care of yourselves.